All righty. How many of you were on the IRB when Dr. Robert Orr was on the IRB? Oh, my goodness, we have changed just a little in a few years here. Yes. Well, it was my pleasure to work on the IRB when Dr. Orr was here. And he was the thoughtful author of the guidance that we now have available on the use of placebos. In case you ever are reviewing something with placebos and want to look at that, Dr. Orr is now back. He was gone for a while in Vermont, and I thought of him in the fall. Every fall I thought of you and thought how fortunate to be there. But we did miss you. He's back as Director of Clinical Ethics, and we're going to be starting. You remember last year we were doing 15-minute segments, giving you some little educational information. This year we're going to focus on ethical challenges based on case studies. So we're pleased to have you back with us, Dr. Orr, and the time is yours. We are going to record these, and we're going to see if we can maybe put them on our IRB website so that people that miss it can go back and listen to them. So that's why I'm holding this, and I'm going to give it to you now, passing of the torch.
All right. Well, well, thank you, and it's a delight to be back and see all these thick protocols and know that I don't have to review them. I sat here for 10 years and read I don't know how many reams of paperwork. But and I thought of you every March. When Vermont is not a pleasant place. Vic Garrison Keillor said this last week, that March is a month invented by God for the benefit of people who don't drink so that they'll know what a hangover is like. So I've been asked by Dr. Rigsby and Dr. Zuccarelli to address a series of questions, 22 questions they gave me. And I decided for the first two sessions to ignore those questions and to give some introductory information, which you're probably familiar with. Because I know that everybody who comes onto the IRB has to do some type of getting up to speed and looking at the history and so on. But I thought it'd be worthwhile because I started in family medicine. I did a fellowship in clinical ethics before I came here. And I did a few empiric studies during fellowship and during my years here. And I recognized the challenge of completing the IRB paperwork and confronting issues and so on. And then I recognized sitting in your seats, the challenge of trying to keep things going. And I used to say, but I'm a physician of integrity. Why should anybody question what I want to do? And I think knowing the history, we can recognize why we have to look at these things. Early human research, the question that you confront every time you meet is, how can the rights of individual persons be reconciled with the demands of the scientific enterprise? And human research has a long history, and some of it is good and some of it's not so good. But way back when, in the 18th century, James Lynn, the surgeon aboard one of the British frigates, identified the cause of scurvy. It took him 6 years to do that, but it made a great, great improvement. And that same century, Edward Jenner tested cowpox on his own children and neighborhood children. And then most everybody knows about John Snow in London in the 19th century, who took the pump handle off the Broad Street pump to prove that cholera was transmitted by drinking water. But in spite of these highlights of good research, or good outcomes anyway, there are many, many instances where things were not done well. But interestingly, the first document that I've been able to uncover about consent was as early as 1900, when Walter Reed was asked to identify the cause of yellow fever, and he established a protocol which included self-experimentation. The members of the Yellow Fever Board were subjects. In fact, one of them died. Only adults could participate in the research. They had a written contract, which would be comparable to our consent document. And they were given an inducement of $100 to participate and another $100 if they got sick. That was a lot of money in those days. It could be considered almost undue inducement, but that's where it was. But in that same period, in looking at the history in Germany. And we must remember that in the 20th century, German medicine was really at the pinnacle. I mean, German physicians received more than 50% of the Nobel Prizes up until 1930. And they were really looked to as the sort of the highlight of medicine all around the world. But in 1900, actually it was the late 1800s, but in 1900 it came to a head, it was learned that some German researchers had given syphilis to prostitutes and to orphans to study the the disease. And this was uncovered. And in 1900, what was his title? The Prussian Minister of Religion and Medical Affairs issued a bulletin with some guidelines, which if you look side by side with what we're doing today, they're really pretty good, 1900. And then in 1932, some German researchers came up with an experimental tuberculosis vaccine and gave it to a lot of children. I don't know what their N was, but 75 children died. And again, this was brought to the fore. This is 1932. Now, this is when the Third Reich was just beginning to take off. And they issued some major regulations for human research in 1932. But then we all know what happened later in the 1930s, 1940s. The experiments on hypothermia, high altitude ingestion of seawater. You have to recognize that those were all experiments that were done for the benefit of the military, for the benefit of the state. What if one of their Luftwaffe pilots was shot down in the North Sea? How long could he survive at cold temperatures? And what type of clothing might protect him? And what if he was stranded and had no other water to drink except seawater? How much, how long, and so on? So they were questions that were put forward, and the researchers took their eyes off the good of the patient and looked to the good of the state. Now, that was the fundamental problem. And we make, at least I make a big deal out of calling research subjects subjects, not patients. And investigators are investigators, not physicians, because of this different hat that you're wearing. When a researcher is presented with a problem that he or she intends to solve, you're taking your eyes off the good of the individual subject, looking for the good of the of patients with that disease or society or medicine as a whole, medicine as a whole or society or whatever. And so it's that change in focus that makes it so important, because most researchers are noble people. Most researchers don't want to harm anybody, but they really want to get their project completed, and they really want to get some answers, and they really want to have some valid data to publish. The other half of the experiment, it wasn't a half and half thing, but the other part of the experiments had to do with sterilization and with infections, induced infections, and with poisons, and with twins. And you probably recognize that those things had to do with the good of the state, again, in establishing the super race. And it's easy to point your fingers at these Nazi researchers and say they were evil men. And I'm here, I'm not here to defend them, but I'm here to say we have to put that in the context of what it is they were trying to accomplish. They really felt that they were trying to do good for the state. And to bring that finger back around towards us, a lot of the things that they did came from early experiments, early things that were done right here in River City. Not necessarily Loma Linda, but right here in the U.S. The U.S. was the first country that did enforced sterilization for eugenic reasons. And this was well established in this country before it was transported across the ocean. In fact, some of those state laws allowing sterilization continued into the 70s. We Americans did research on prisoners. Some on U.S. soil, but some in Manila, which was under our jurisdiction at that time. And I mean, it was understandable. You've got a population which is confined and accessible, and it's easy to coerce them and so on. And unfortunately, our country has a rather bleak history of racial discrimination. But when you take all these things together, and please don't read me wrong, I'm not saying that the U.S. was responsible for the racial hygiene program of the Nazis, but the seeds of that were things that were thought of in our society, or taken and distorted and magnified in Germany as well. And as you know, after the war, the Nuremberg doctors' trials put just 23 physicians on trial. The estimate is that there were hundreds of physicians involved in these unethical experiments and in the death camps and so on. And seven were sentenced to death, some of whom cheated that by committing suicide. So it was actually a very small number. I mean, it was a big deal, but it was a small number of individuals. And it didn't get a lot of press in the U.S. until the actual sentencing. And then when the Nuremberg Code was handed down after that, a direct result of these things in Germany, it's perhaps too flippant to say, but researchers in North America and other countries said, that Nuremberg Code, that was for those evil German doctors. It doesn't really apply to us. And so it really didn't have the impact that it should have. I mean, it was a major international effort to clean up the human research industry. But looking at our own society, the Willowbrook study, I think in your handout you were given a very poor copy, I'm sorry, of this New England Journal article from 1966. Henry Beecher was an anesthesiologist at Harvard who had a great deal to say, and he was a very influential person in early medical ethics. I say early medical ethics, early contemporary ethics. And he published this study in the New England Journal reporting on 22 studies that were clearly unethical. And I'm not going to bother to go through them, but you will, if you peruse the article, you see that some involved withholding effective treatment. In soldiers were not given penicillin when they had known strep infections, and some ended up with rheumatic fever, and some with glomerulonephritis. Other antibiotic experiments, side effects of chloramphenicol, low dose versus high dose, found a much higher incidence of aplastic anemia with high dose. Some physiologic studies on cyclopropane anesthesia, cerebral blood flow, adverse circulatory responses from intra-abdominal manipulation and so on, just things that are unacceptable. And they were unacceptable in 1966, but they were done and they were published and nobody batted an eyelid. And Henry Beecher said, wait a minute, look at what we're doing. We need to be more conscientious. And this quote from the end of his article, which I've used repeatedly in teaching, is, an experiment is ethical or not at its inception. It does not become ethical post hoc. So that's why we're here, because we're looking at the inception of research, and we should be able to determine if it's ethical or not. But in our own U.S. 20th century history, we have the Willowbrook studies on which children in residential home for developmentally disabled children on Long Island were intentionally given hepatitis to study the efficacy of gamma globulin with consent of their parents. The Tuskegee study is probably the most infamous, and it started in 1932. And again, don't get me wrong, I'm not defending the researchers, but in 1932, there was really very little effective treatment for syphilis. What was it called? Salvarsan or something, one of the heavy metals was used, and it was poisonous. And it was not very effective. But they established this study, a longitudinal study, to look at the long-term effects of syphilis. Started in 1932, but then 1940, 41, penicillin was developed, and they were not given penicillin, and they continued until 1972. Clearly unethical. And the subjects were poor, poorly educated black men who had syphilis and were given periodic testing and were given a free meal when they came for testing. I mean, they even had lumbar punctures done. And they were given treatment for minor symptoms, and they felt they were getting some supervision. If you ever get a chance to see the play, Miss Evers' Boys, it's really a worthwhile and very sad documentary of what happened. And this Miss Evers was the nurse in charge of the program, and the subjects really adored her. They thought very highly of what she was doing for them, when in fact she and the researchers were withholding known effective treatment. Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital injected live cancer cells into chronically ill patients. And then the radiation experiments, which went on for years and years. And you may remember that, was it President Clinton that issued the apology? I think it was President Clinton, just a few years ago, after a prolonged study of the hundreds of experiments that were done for the benefit of society, so we can learn more about radiation, not only in a military fashion, but even in a medical therapy fashion. And the conclusion was, Ruth Faden was the principal reviewer of all this. She had a large committee. The conclusion was that many were wronged, but few were harmed. And it's tempting to say, well, not many people were harmed, so therefore it's okay. No, it's not okay. The wrong happened at the inception of the experiment, when people were exposed to radiation with unknown effects to see what the effect would be. So that's why we're here. And it's important to remember that individual clinicians have a fiduciary duty to their individual patients to do what's in their best interest. But when that individual clinician puts on a researcher's hat, they adopt a secondary interest of helping science, helping society to come up with some usable information. And in doing so, they may very well compromise their primary fiduciary duty to the patient. And so you are charged with trying to prevent that from happening. It's a tough job, a lot of reading, a lot of speculating. But I really admire the work that's done by IRBs. Now, next time, I propose to just say a little bit about the documents that we use as our basis, the Belmont Report and the other reports that we use. And then I have this list of 22 topics to choose from. And I don't have any particular bias as to which we'll do first. Some of them look so difficult, I'm not sure I'll have anything to add to the confusion on the topics. But I'll be glad to address them. And if any of you have some that you think are particularly pertinent, please let me know and I'll move that up the scale. Questions, comments about this or about where we're headed?
Reasonable corollary one might conclude is that if it also does not become unethical post hoc, are there protections in place for people that preclude a shift in ethical standards from punishing physicians who were acting under a particular ethical standard? And I'm thinking of Nuremberg here.
Right. That's actually a very good question, because I have maintained on many occasions that we shouldn't judge the German physicians based on today's standards. But at the same time, I just point out they did have some standards which they did not meet. But you're right that we should not look backwards and say, well, they did a bad job because they did something different from what I think is right or wrong. And because of advancing technology and advancing power of things that we can do to people, I think we have a higher responsibility now than a generation ago to protect subjects. So yes, I think we should be careful not to adversely judge somebody for a past event.
mentors who you probably know, Dr. Lester Rumble, knew Henry Beecher personally, the anesthesiologist, and would tell us of his concern about young men who were on the angio beachhead that were hit by shrapnel or gunfire or whatever and had no pain until they got back to comfortable surroundings and sympathetic nurses and a venipuncture created tremendous pain. And he followed the same people, same nervous system. So it's interesting that Beecher started working on this earlier. Secondly, Rumble did experiments that were acceptable in the mid-50s in Atlanta at Emory when he was there using prisoners, which they said they would shorten their sentence, and I think we have it in the department. I'm not sure where it is. I could ask Dot. But they basically proved that CPR would be effective, and they paralyzed prisoners and left them there. They paralyzed them awake with sex and had Boy Scouts. I mean, they had like a little 5 or 6 year old doing CPR on these guys, breathing for them to show that you could bring somebody back if they were stopped. And he has the whole footage of it, and it would shorten the prisoner's time frame. Yeah, I mean, they were there to rescue him with a mass ventilation and everything else, but I thought that was interesting. And I don't know if they had IRBs back then, but obviously they started teaching people CPR and saying it will work.
No, they didn't have IRBs until the 1970s. And those are good points. And I might just point out that in the second page of the handout, I think you had a one-page handout of the notes, and then a second with some references. And I would, if you're interested in pursuing that about prisoners, I would particularly recommend a book called Acres of Skin. Because there was a researcher in Philadelphia who was doing some dermatologic research, and he went into a prison and looked over the prison yard and said, oh, there's acres of skin. And he just started doing things. And many prisoners were offered early release or extra liberties and benefits within the prison walls, and some of them suffered serious harms as a result of this. But it's an interesting history. And there was actually an article that just came out last month that wasn't out, or I should say I wasn't aware of it when I put together this bibliography, and you might be interested in it. It's called Overview of German Nazi and Holocaust Medicine. And I have no idea if any of you are as interested in this aspect of history as I am. I brought 3 copies of it in case anybody is interested. I'll leave them here. But it's from the American Journal of Medical Genetics from February of this year. But it's really a very insightful article. Well, thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Back to you, Madam Chair.